The Touching the Trail Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Touching the Trail Podcast, our weekly ritual of peace, presence, and perseverance. This week's episode is episode 180 with this week's guest, Steve House. And before we jump into who Steve is, I just want to take care of a little business. Now, there are two ways that you can support Touching the Trail. The first is that you can go to touchingthetrail.com/donate to donate to the show. And the second way is that you can go to targetreleaserecovery.com to pick up your very own Basecamp and Peak handheld deep tissue massage tools. And both those links are in the show notes. Now, who is Steve House? Well, Steve is an accomplished climber, very accomplished, and along with his co-author Scott Johnston, last week's podcast guest, he is the author of Training for the New Alpinism, a manual for the climber as athlete, and the new book Training for the Uphill Athlete, a manual for mountain runners and ski mountaineers. And that he is the co-founder of the coaching company Uphill Athlete, along with Scott Johnston. Now, as I said last week on Scott's episode, I first heard about Scott and Steve by hearing about Training for the New Alpinism and their unique approach to taking long known and long understood training practices from more conventional sports and just more conventional applications of those training practices and applying them to alpinism and now to mountain running and ski mountaineering, just to endurance in general. And this is kind of the paired episode with last week's episode because it'll give you Steve's perspective on the story of Uphill Athlete, of Training for the New Alpinism, of his relationship with Scott Johnston, and how Scott's coaching of Steve radically helped Steve have the best years of climbing in his life. And become an extremely well-known and respected climber and accomplish some incredible routes around the world. And that's really what we delve into today. We delve into Steve's story and we delve into how training smart, training right, was able to make him into the climber that he became and make him become the best to his ability that he could. And then how they took that knowledge and shared it out in the world with the books and the coaching that they do, he and Scott. So I really hope that you enjoyed today's episode, and I think there's a lot of knowledge in here for you guys, you listeners today, even if you're not a mountaineer or an alpinist, if you're a runner, or a cyclist, a swimmer, whatever you do, I definitely think there's a lot you can take away today from just perspectives on how to train, perspectives on endurance, and perspectives on getting outside and pushing yourself to your limits and then beyond, and taking that step beyond what you think you're capable of. And that is exactly what Steve House does. And so please enjoy my conversation with Steve House. I want to start at the beginning, obviously. It's a good place to start, as always. And I'm curious, you know, how the outdoors and adventure, how they played a role in your childhood and your growing up, if they did at all.
Oh, absolutely. My childhood was mostly spent outdoors. And adventure was something that we actively sought as a family, I would say. I grew up in northeastern Oregon, so a pretty small town, about 10,000 people. But, you know, that's a really beautiful area. We have, you know, wilderness areas on two sides of the valley I lived in. And we did a ton of, I did basically everything outside as a kid, like, We hunted and fished, but we also backpacked and skied and, like, you know, hiked and rock climbed and did some peak bagging and all kinds of things. I mean, I did everything I could outside, I would say.
Yeah, it's very different from my growing up. I grew up in LA, so it's always funny for me to hear people guest, you know, to talk about, you know, their childhood and spent outside. Typically, a lot of the people I talk to, and I was outside too, but, you know, it's a big city and it's stark difference to having wilderness on both sides of the valley.
Yeah, I could literally go a block and a half, and behind that distance, there was just a mountain, like, you know, just covered with ponderosa pine trees and,
right.
and streams coming down it, and there was wildlife there, and it was like, 1,000 vertical feet to climb up to the top of that little hill mountain. We had a name for it, El Mountain. that was kind of what I did spent a lot of time doing.
And out of all these sports these outdoor activities that you were doing, how did climbing kind of rise above the rest?
Yeah, I learned to climb from my parents, which was actually kind of rare in that era. I was born in 1970, and my dad had learned to climb when he was a younger man stationed in Germany in the army. He was a welder working on a tank battalion in southern Germany, and one of his friends there recruited him and taught him to climb because he needed a climbing partner. And my dad thought that was pretty cool. But as I grew up, it was something my dad would do one or two times a year with his friends, and it was something that a little bit my sister as well, would do once or twice a year. It wasn't a huge part of most of my growing up until I got to be about 16, 17. And then some of my other friends also got interested in rock climbing. And then we all rock climb, and we were educated enough to like set up our own top ropes and do a little bit of lead climbing and that kind of stuff. But we didn't have rock climbing shoes. We would climb in hiking boots. And this was also in the era before people bolted rock climbs. That really didn't start until the late 80s, early 90s in this country. So we had to place our own protection and so forth. It was pretty primitive back then. We didn't have camming devices, for example. We just had chalk. So it was a little more complicated to get into. But the real thing for me was I went as an exchange student. I took a gap year and became an exchange student in what was then Yugoslavia. And now it's the part of Yugoslavia called Slovenia, now an independent country. Of course, it was Slovenia then, too. It was just a republic of Yugoslavia at that right. time. And I was there in 88 and 89, about 6-7 years before Slovenia broke off from Yugoslavia and the Balkan War started and all that. But I went over there without any climbing gear. But after about 2 months, I was just kind of searching for some friends, some community. So my host family and I located the local climbing club, and I went down to this local climbing club, and immediately, like that night, like I can still remember that night. I can still remember who I talked to. I can still remember the plans we made. I made like lifelong friends literally that night who I still keep in touch with, who I have seen within the last 2 months even. And they immediately I was off and running with those guys, and we climbed all the time. And I actually dropped out of school and just climbed all the time. I climbed 5 days a week. I climbed over 180 days that year. So that was for sure where I was like bitten by the bug.
Do you think that the community that it provided you there, and like having people, friends that you could make there, was a big reason why you kind of fell in love with it so quickly?
Absolutely it was. And, it was partly because of the logistics of, I was doing my gap year after I graduated from high school. And so the kids in the quote unquote high school that I was supposed to go to were younger than I was. They were all year younger. And I think emotionally, I grew up in a pretty independent way that I worked all summer starting at age 12 on a ranch. Like I had my own money. I had my own car. Like I had, like I was a pretty, I wasn't super mature, but I was relative to them, a pretty mature 18-year-old. And so when I found these people in this climbing club, they were all older than I am, but that was more my level. Like they were adults, and that's the way I saw myself. And climbing was a thing you did as a free person, right? Like it was like, what do you want to do? Like, well, I want to go climbing. That's freedom, right? Doing what you want to do. So we did a lot of climbing, a little bit of ski touring, and the community was amazing. And, and it still is. They've got a great climbing community over there. And I think to a large extent, we have that community here in North America, too. It's just gotten a lot bigger. It used to be really, really small. but over the last 20 years, I've seen it just explode. So it's still a great community.
And how did you kind of take, after your gap year there, how did you take your climbing back into America and fall in love with it there? I mean, did you...
Well, I needed to go to university and get an undergraduate degree. That was expected. And I did that, and I think it was good for me, although I never have used my degree in the sense of getting a job or anything. It took me 6 years to finish my degree. I took a lot of time off to go climbing, and in the meantime, I started working in the summers as a climbing instructor. I started taking some of the very, very first American Mountain Guide Association courses. I became one of the very, very first certified alpine guides back in 1992. And I realized right away that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be outside working as a mountain guide and sharing this thing I love, this climbing and to a lesser extent ski touring and ski mountaineering with other people and teaching skills and taking people, lead guiding ascents and descents and so forth.
And so I'm curious, you know, moving kind of into this progression of yours of climbing and, you know, how deeper and deeper into your passion for it. And I'm curious, you know, moving into like this, your trajectory towards, you know, your teaming up with Scott Johnston and everything else and your training kind of story. I'm curious to hear you talk about a little bit about what happened on Nuptse East and how, you know, your realization that you did have a lack of fitness and that you weren't where you thought you were. And this is down the road a little bit.
Ahead, like a good 5 to 8 years in the story. But so I'll just give it a little background is that I was just completely, one of the best things about working as a mountain guide was that I had 6 to 8 months a year off. I mean, I lived on $10,000-$12,000 a year, but I had tons of time off and I could just live in my truck and climb a lot in the off seasons. And then, you know, that climbing a lot got me to a pretty high level. And, when I wasn't climbing for myself, I was working as a mountain guide. So I was outside just a ton. And so I got a relatively good level of fitness from that. And more importantly, climbing is a skill sport. And I really worked on my skills. And I'm a pretty, I'm a kind of person who works on things. Like, I, of course, enjoy just climbing, but I don't know, it's just my mentality is like, oh, I'm going to try to get better at this. And I'd spend like 6 months trying to get better at that. You know, if whatever that thing is, usually a particular sort of sub-discipline of climbing, how I was. So I got pretty good at the climbing skills. I worked really hard on that. So by the time I went on this Nuptse climb in 2001, I was pretty fit, but just from climbing and guiding. I had never really trained in an organized way. And on that expedition, I climbed with this guy, Marco Prezo, who's a Slovenian climber, who had actually met in Alaska. I didn't even meet him in Slovenia, but we had a bunch of mutual friends. And once again, that connection at that time I spent in Slovenia kind of coming back to repay my my life karma bank or whatever. Marco and I were on this climb, and he was just way better than I was. He was just way stronger. And the longer the climb went on, the more that became apparent. When I came back from that trip, I was like, man, I've done all this climbing. Like at that point, I was already starting to get some recognition, get some sponsors. And in this day and age, like if everything was snail mail, print magazines, and like these things happened much more slowly. And the only magazines would only print information about climbers that they considered significant. So you kind of had to get through this gatekeeper of the climbing magazine news editor before you get your name published, and then that's how you would get recognition and potentially sponsors and those kinds of things. So this whole thing would move much more slowly back then, and I was already in that, like, well established in that era, I had all the same sponsors I basically do now. I wasn't really making any money from that, but I at least was getting equipment and stuff. So I accomplished a fair bit, and I was pretty shocked that Marco could basically crush me like that. So I got back from that trip and I hired a coach. And 6 months later, I was literally in the hospital. Like, she overtrained me really badly, and I was super eager, so I just did everything she said without questioning, and I didn't know anything. And it was also kind of a coaching relationship that was pretty, like, top-down. She just told me what to do. I don't ever remember her asking me how I felt, for example. And so by the time I started to come out of that illness, Scott, who was just a climbing acquaintance, he was like a person I knew through climbing and had climbed with him, but didn't know him super well. He basically said, hey, why don't you come over to my house? I'll make you lunch and chat a bit. And that's basically the first time he revealed that, like, hey, you know, I've been not only climbing for my entire life, which at that point was, you know, he was almost 50, but I've also been a coach of all these really high-level endurance athletes, especially cross-country skiing, and I think I can help you, and I think your coach was making some big mistakes, and he started to teach me some things even that day. And, you know, Scott took over my training, and, you know, boom, that was a major, major shift in, you know, my career as a professional climber, as an athlete. And, you know, for the next 10 years, Scott pretty much ruled my life.
When you were there on Nupsi with Marco, did you feel that, like, were you talking with him on, like, why he was so much fitter than you, stronger than you? Were you trying to figure this out, or did you just feel like you just needed to climb more, or that you just weren't doing enough?
At the time, it was just, I was just trying to keep up. And I couldn't. So, I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of conversation happening.
Right.
And, you know, he wasn't training. But as Scott will be the first to tell people, and often does, I'm not a gifted athlete. Marco is probably a gifted athlete. So we had the same sort of, let's say, training diet, which was just a lot of climbing, but he has much more talent than I do. And so he could, like, he could do much better than I could. I don't have that talent. I'm kind of mediocre. Like, you know, and I did all those sports when I was a kid or whatever. Like, I went to a high school with 800 kids, and I was, like, the fourth fastest guy on the cross-country running team when I was a senior. Like, I wasn't any special aerobic or, you know, endurance athlete. I was just kind of a active kid that liked sports. So one of the things that Scott brought to the table, you know, through this training was, you know, and one of the great things about climbing as a sport is it's not competitive. I mean, if I had wanted to be in the Olympics as a runner or whatever, they would have looked at my times and they would have just, you know, laughed me out of the room. No matter, they would have said, well, no matter how much coaching you get, you'll never be great. And that's probably almost certainly true. I would never have been a great runner, but I could be with climbing. My goal was not to be the best. I wasn't trying to beat anyone. I was just trying to be my best. And that's the beautiful thing about climbing as a quote-unquote sport. I don't even think the term sport really applies to the climbing arts or the climbing practices, as I like to think of them.
Why not? Why don't you think it? What do you consider it?
Well, up until very, very recently, there's never been any competition in climbing, which I think we have enough competition. There's lots of avenues in this world for humans to compete against one another. And I think it's really beautiful to have some of the most demanding physical things that you can imagine, climbing specifically, be completely impossible to compare individuals between one another. The way we view success, especially in mountaineering, is like, look at a person's career. Like, what did they accomplish over their lifetime in mountaineering? It's not about, like, whereas racing is typically about who's faster than who on that day. It's like, yeah, on, you know, June 21st, 2019, you know, George was faster than Sam. Therefore, George gets a gold medal. You know, it's a little different. And,
right.
You know, it's not competitive. And B, like, I think that climbing, mountaineering, all these things, they're not really sports because they're not There's none of the hallmarks that you have, like, you think of, like, baseball or running, or there's no benchmarks, there's no events, there's no, like, Boston Marathon of mountaineering, right? Like, there's no, I mean, there are routes, and a lot of us will climb the same routes, but they're not timed, and we don't even do it at the same time. So, you know, I mean, there's just a ton of differences. I really think that, you know, it's a little bit, I mean, the best analogy, I think, is a little more like yoga, where the goal is to practice and through practice get better as a person. You know, and that's physically, that's mentally, you know, it's whatever you need to work on, but it all comes up when you're out there kind of facing yourself.
How do you think climbing, like, itself betters you? You know, like, why do you return to it so, as a passion of yours, you know, how does it, what aspects of it do that
well,
for you, do that yoga practice
question.
For you?
Kind of? And I'll answer this by saying that I can't think of a single human endeavor that is, especially a physical endeavor, that is more multifaceted and more complex than alpine mountaineering. I mean, I have to be able to rock climb, which is already a really hard thing to do. I have to be able to ice climb, which is another really hard thing to do. I have to be able to mix climb, which is when you combine rock and ice. I have to be able to know everything there is to know about snow and avalanches and mountain weather. I have to know a whole massive amount of different kinds of technical skills to make this all safe. I have to know the like geography, you know, I have to know multiple languages, like I have to know an infinitesimal number of things. I can't think of anything else that has that, that's that interesting. Like what else, like, okay, like I have a friend that's into is a really good photographer. He doesn't do it professionally, he does it as an artist. And, you know, I mean, his photos, I can tell you, they are beautiful. Like they're somehow stunning, and he can see things and create things with light and shadow that I certainly can't see and no one else can see. But at the end of the day, I look at it and I'm like, you know, I can see how a person can teach himself that. It's not that complicated. It's light and shadow. It's, you know, of course there's some interpretation, but, you know, the technical part isn't really that complicated. So, I mean, and I'm sure I'm underestimating how complex photography is, for example, or to be a very good photographer. But like that's one thing that people would think of as like this incredibly hard thing to do, this hard skill to master. When I compare that to what I have to know as a mountaineer, as an alpine climber, it seems like a few percentage points of what I have to know as a climber. And I've been doing it my whole life, and I still don't know everything. There's still tons to learn. So I think that those are all reasons why I'm attracted to it and why I like it and why I think it's so unique.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was going to say when you were saying about the competition is like the variability of this, the activity, the sport, the art, you know, whatever we're going to call it here itself is kind of eliminates competition, you know, with weather, with, you know, how the mountain is that day, with snow, with everything else, with individuals' preparation levels. Like you even said, with the fact that you don't do the routes on the same day, obviously, like, it kind of eliminates competition as a possibility in the way that competition is conventionally kind of conceived of.
Absolutely, yeah. Which is great. I love that.
Right.
I mean, that is getting introduced a little bit. Now they have this thing called fastest known time, which, I mean, you're probably aware of. You know,
right.
It comes a little bit from trail running and stuff, and people are applying that to, especially mountaineering, like, and okay, for like, a mountain like Everest that's super non-technical, it's just a walk up and the only challenge is the distance and the altitude. That can semi make sense, but still you're not gonna have people quote unquote competing the record on the same day in the same conditions. So it's always gonna be a little bit different.
Right.
And that's beautiful.
And even you yourself talk about alpinism as well. Would you say that there is a difference between mountaineering and alpinism? I mean, do you think, are there two different concepts to you?
Yeah, so the way I define that is mountaineering is typically climbing a mountain by the easiest way you can get to the top of that mountain, basically. Like, you look at the mountain, you do a little reconnaissance, or you do some research, and be like, okay, if we go up here and follow this route, that'll be the most efficient and effective way to get to the summit. The main goal is getting to the summit. That's really, but alpinism, it's a little bit different in that the goal is much more aesthetically rooted, in the sense that the goal is really to find the perfect experience for you and your partner for that moment via the mountain. And that opens up like climbing whatever you see as beautiful. And a lot of that is also choosing the one that presents the right amount of challenge. I mean, within alpinism, you have routes that are so extreme that, you know, in terms of their difficulty, that they're never repeated. Like, nobody else ever goes up there again because they hear the report at the first ascensionist and they just, people write it off and they're like, okay, well, I'll never do that again. I think a great example is, you know, that a lot of people know, a lot of people have heard of this mountain in Switzerland called the Eiger. And the Eiger itself is not even a 4,000 meter peak. So it's not on the list of peak baggers. And it has multiple relatively easy routes to get up that most people with basic mountaineering skills can negotiate. But what's compelling about the Eiger is it has this 6,000 foot north face, you know, that they climbed in 1938. That is this incredibly difficult and beautiful mountain wall. And that wall now has, I don't know, 20, 25 different routes up of, and some of those, as I said, have never been repeated. And even the 1938 route is still like a much sought after objective among alpinists. They want to climb it. It's not the easiest way, but it is potentially the most beautiful way. And it's also, in that case, filled with history because it was attempted and men died on the attempts. And, there's all these stories surrounding it. So the experience is very, very multifaceted of climbing the north face of the Eiger. And if you've climbed the north face of the Eiger, like, you know, you're one of only a handful of people. It probably gets climbed by 10 or 20 people a year. And, you know, I mean, that's a lot. Fewer people have climbed the north face of the Eiger than have climbed Mount Everest. So, that keeps it really interesting.
Right. It seems to me that, you know, like this, the competition is kind of not really possible in this activity and this art and this sport. And the fact, you know, especially with alpinism, it's aesthetic approach with the dangers involved with it. It all seems like this is a very... that community is a very like logical kind of extension of all of this, and I'm curious how, you know, the people that you've met and the life that you've led in this sport, how community has played a role, because that seems like a very key aspect of it all to me, at least in my outside perspective of mountaineering, since I've never participated.
It's a great question, and I would answer it like this, like, you know, all of the people that are closest to me in my life, I know through climbing. I mean, Scott Johnson, you know, I mean, I talk to Scott every day. We've been friends for 30 years. My best friend here in Colorado that I see all the time, and he now has some kids, and I have young children. And we own another business together that's a guiding company that we started back in 1997. That is one of the most important friendships in my life. I mean, he's the guy who was obviously the obvious and only, almost only choice to be the best man at my wedding, kind of a thing. I met my wife through the mountaineering community. Most of my friends, I mean, I live in a small town, so of course I have friends here in town that we have kids the same age, we have other interests that are similar, and so we're friends, but that's kind of in my sort of daily world, that's a little bit the exception that I interact with anybody that isn't from the mountaineering community, or climbing community. So it's been a very strong, shaper in my life.
Mm-hmm. So kind of moving back into that time in 2001, 2002, when, you know, you were training hard and you were becoming overtrained, I'm curious did you not feel that you were becoming overtrained? Did you just feel like your coach had everything under control and like just keep working at it?
I didn't know the difference. I didn't know anything. I literally got overtrained that I got a virus.
Right.
And the virus put me in the hospital. Like, I mean, that's, you know, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. I didn't know.
Right.
Like, and she wasn't really asking me. Like, when I coach now, the first thing I ask every athlete every morning is, how are you feeling? How do you feel? Like, I just have it on, I just have that little phrase saved, and I just copy and paste it into like 10 texts every morning and ask every single athlete first thing in the morning how they're feeling. Because that's the most important piece of information you could have as a coach.
And yeah, it's like the virus was your body's way of saying, like, let's slow everything down, Steve. Let's take a moment.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that happens when people get overtrained. Your immune system gets really depressed.
Right.
And that virus probably wouldn't have, you know, even, I might not have even gotten sick at all had I not been, you know, in a depleted state. But my immune system was super depressed, and I got this thing, and it knocked me out really hard.
And how did your you know, your relationship with Scott kind of bring you out of that and start to teach you how to train right and how to actually train for this for climbing?
Yeah, Scott's methodology is very much to, and that's kind of, I think, one of the main reasons that our books are the way they are and our website, uphillathlete.com, is the way it is. Is because Scott's MO has always been to teach. He wants you to understand what's going on. And so that's how he started with me. I mean, from that very first day, I remember the first thing he was explaining to me that day I can remember is how you have to layer, in his words, layer training volume on gradually. Meaning, you know, he thought that one of the coaches, mistakes my coach had made is that she had increased the training volume from week to week too quickly, and that had been one of the causes of the overtraining episode. And so he was saying, you know, look, okay, you trained 14 hours this week, and then you train maybe 14 and a half or 15 hours the next week. You don't jump to 18. Like, that's your body can't absorb that much additional load in that short amount of time. You know, just that's very much his style. And those first, I'd say, so I got better late winter, early spring, and then I was leaving for an expedition. I had already planned this expedition in Pakistan in the Karakoram that summer. I kind of got back to, let's say, par by the time I left for that trip, but I'd say that the real training didn't start until I came back from that trip, and I had a whole 9 months of uninterrupted, like, you know, organized training and coaching, working with Scott. And that's when I was like, oh, okay. That's kind of when the first time I really got it, because my fitness was all of a sudden like jumping to these levels that I had never imagined even existed in terms of what I could, how long I could go, what I could do.
And what would you say that Scott was doing well differently than you had been applying or doing beforehand, before you met him and started working with him?
Well, I think that mostly what my prior coach was doing was basically the same. I mean, all of this, that's one of the things that we like to tell people all the time now is, you know, with our methodologies that we talk about through our books and our website, we're not claiming to invent anything new. In fact, the opposite. What we're claiming is to be sharing what we would call proven training knowledge, and proven in the sense that this is what all real endurance athletes on any kind of high level do. It's what all the coaches do. It's well understood why all this stuff works. There's no silver bullets. There's no shortcuts. There's no magic pill, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's just this basic concept where you create a large aerobic base by doing a lot of low intensity, high volume work in whatever the athlete's sport is. So for me, that was like a lot of walking uphill and running eventually uphill. And then on top of that, you build, you add the intensity, and you weave into that the strength that is needed for the sport. So with climbing, it's a pretty full body activity, but it's mostly pulling, upper body pulling and lower body pushing. So that, and a lot of core. So those dictate some certain things that you might do as in terms of strength training. And so the first coach I had was basically doing the same, using that same approach. She's not a bad coach. She just didn't understand climbing because she came from cross-country skiing. And she was a cross-country ski coach for the Canadian women's cross-country ski team. But she did not understand climbing. And she also didn't understand really me. And I was also, besides training, I was also working my normal job as a mountain guide. So I'd wake up at 4 a.m, train, be done and be at work, you know, meeting my guests for guiding at 7 a.m. And then going out and ski touring all day. Like, and she never asked about that. So she just didn't think about it. I think she had no idea what that meant when I told her, well, I'm a mountain guide. She didn't know what that meant. I think she thought I like hiked around and pointed squirrels out to people. you know, and actually I was like taking people on big tours. So, you know, it's nobody's fault. And her approach was basically the same. But one of the things that Scott brought that was so fortuitous for me was that he also, besides the training and coaching background he had a climbing background. So he knew what a mountain guide, he knows what a mountain guide does. He knows what climbing is. He's done it for years, years and years.
Why is putting in that work to understand your athlete as a coach and have those conversations and ask how they're feeling in the morning, why is that so important?
Well, you know, for multiple reasons, but on the most basic level, you have to have health before you can have fitness or before you can improve work to improve. Because when you're training, you're basically breaking somebody down. You're wearing them out. You're inducing fatigue. You're making them tired on purpose so that they will bounce back from that and be a little more resilient than they were before the training session. So, you know, if you look at it that way, you realize, oh, okay, well, if this person isn't healthy and feeling like generally pretty positive, then I need to dig in and find out why. And if they say, yeah, I'm okay, but I'm tired, and I ask a couple more questions and I ascertain, you know, and they ascertain that we agree that they're just tired from the workout yesterday, but it's not too bad. And a lot of times I might say, well, let's start the workout, but you know, if after, you know, do this gradual warm up and it's going to take 15 minutes. And if after that 15 minutes, you don't feel like training, call me and let's talk it through. And oftentimes I pull the plug there, right? Like, you know, and we'll just say, okay, let's do this workout tomorrow. Why don't you go home and rest and get a good lunch, whatever. That's kind of the difference between coaching and having like a training plan. One of the problems, I mean, and we create training plans all the time. We sell them on our website and stuff. And they are a cost-effective roadmap for people to follow that is well built. But, you know, life is complicated and stress manifests itself in many ways. And if you have a stressful job or a stressful relationship or your car breaks down or your dog dies or any one of a number of bad things happen, that creates stress, and stress wears you out. It grinds you down. And, you know, that may make you less ready for training than you would have been otherwise. May affect your sleep, all these other things. And so this kind of thing is the difference between like following a plan, which may be well intentioned, but still it's not an intelligent being in the way that as a coach you also lay out a plan. It's just that you modify it a little bit almost every day.
So I'm curious how, you know, over these years, this time that you had spent being coached by Scott, how that, you know, because you talk about how that those were the best years of climbing of your life, and just a little bit about talk about that and how what you were learning and doing with Scott, you were able to take that into the mountains and be successful out there. I'm curious, you know, what your perspective was on that now in hindsight and what you were able to accomplish.
Yeah, I mean, it was really great during that sort of 10-year run, I'd say, of a couple of things came together for me. One, I got to a point with my climbing that I could climb full time, which meant I could train full time. And by that point, luckily for me, I was already a little older. I was in my early 30s when that started. So that gave me the kind of, I think, perspective and maturity to be smart about how I did that. And also Scott was really helpful in talking this through. And I would essentially set you know, a primary goal for each year in terms of climbing. And we would build the training around that. And then I would try to have a secondary goal. So because with mountaineering and climbing was tight, you know, you could go on an expedition, have bad weather and not have any chance to do anything. So, we just kind of try to have something so I could get something kind of more or less significant done every year. And we would do this in multiple ways. One is I would build training camps into my year. So for that's what we called them, but actually they were climbing trips. So for example, you know, my main expedition was in August and September, which was quite common. You know, I would in March, April timeframe do a 4 to 6 week climbing trip where I would train, but I would also climb and hopefully do something kind of good. And I would go again early summer, try to do something that was, you know, like 80% of what the big project was. And then I'd have the big project. And between those three, you know, trips, I would always get at least a couple of things, quote unquote, accomplished, which was good for me mentally and feeling like I was progressing as a climber. And it also allowed me to kind of, you know, there's different components of climbing. Like, for example, a lot of the things I got really interested in at the end happened at super high altitude, like over 25,000 feet, you know, the highest, you know, 10 mountains in the world. Those were kind of the peaks I was looking at and trying to climb these really hard routes on. And so it was good for me to like be able to take the technical skills and separate that from the altitude at least once a year, because the altitude makes everything vastly more complex. So, you know, there's some things like that were really good. And it was a great time period. And I did a lot of really great climbing. I'm super happy to have been able to do that. I see when I look back, you know, I'm 48 and I've sort of had this like 10-year period where I was working as a mountain guide and climbing a lot. And then I had a 10-year period where I was basically a professional climber, just training and climbing, eat, sleep, climb, train. And then I had a really bad accident in 2010. And, you know, I knew at the time, and I can even confirm this now, years later, that it effectively ended my ability to be that strong and fit. And I still have residual physical problems from that accident. And but that also led me into, I mean, we wrote the first book we did together, Training for the New Alpinism, because I called Scott and was like, Scott, like, let's write a book about what we were doing because I need a project. Like, I'm going crazy. I'm like sitting, you know, I was in a wheelchair for several months after that accident. And then for several months after that, I couldn't really walk further than into my driveway. So, you know, I needed something to do, even if it was mental. I needed a goal. I needed a focus. And so, you know, our first book actually came out of that. And that kind of launched this last and current, I would say, period where we're writing these books, we're building this website, we're really, you know, making a big effort to educate people in the mountain sports about correct training methods. And there's another difference between conventional sport and unconventional sport, as I would call it, like mountaineering and climbing or backcountry skiing, is conventional sport has training built into it. Like if you get into swimming as a kid, I mean, like that whole thing is built, a whole experience of swimming or running or wrestling or playing football or basketball or baseball. All those experiences, those are all built around training. Five or six days a week, right? Like you go to practice. They call it practice, but really it's training. Unconventional sports don't have that. We don't have like you have to create that yourself. So those participants tend to not know how training should work because they never experienced it in any other sport. Because a lot of people come into mountaineering and climbing sports having never done any other sport, because they weren't attracted to, they were turned off by competition, you know, a lot of times. They were turned off by group sports, those kinds of things.
And so is that why you and Scott felt that you needed, that this book needed to be written, so that you could provide this knowledge to the people out there that might not know it?
Yeah, you know, I wrote a book that was published in 2009 called Beyond the Mountain, which is a book about my climbing stories. And when I did a book tour for that year, people kept asking me, what do you do for training? It was always the first question when I started would do the Q&A. And I initially told Scott about that, and we sort of had this conversation, and we said, yeah, we should do that. We'll write down what we've been doing, and it'll be 100 pages, and we'll go to Kinko's, and we'll run off 100 copies, and we'll give it away to all our friends. Because, you know, literally that's the – we talked about this earlier, the size of the climbing community. It was that small. And nobody else was training. Like, I was the first professional climber to train in this way. Like, people would, quote-unquote, trained before, but they would just, like – really just exercise. They would be like, okay, I should go running today, or I'm going to go skiing today. They didn't have a coach. They didn't have a plan. They didn't have knowledge about how training works. They just went and exercise. They call it training. So I was really like, you know, Scott and I were breaking some ground here, and we didn't really think we did it as a public service, honestly, because, and you don't make money writing books. That's just a fact. It's just authors just, I mean, okay, if you sell a million copies, maybe now you're going to make some real money. But, you know, we expected to sell 2,000 copies. And it took us 3 years to write. And on 2,000 copies, I could figure out the royalty here, we would have made $6,750 between the two of us. So we would have made some money, right? Like, I mean, you know, we could have like gone on a little vacation or, you know, done a trip to Asia and climbed a mountain or done something cool. But that's not really like a career path. You know, you can't work for 3 years and make like $3,000, you know? So we really did do it as basically a public service. What happened is that now that book has sold over 60,000 copies. And the reason that happened was that other athletes in other sports, especially mountain running and ski touring and ski mountaineering, were using our book because they didn't have anything like it for their sports. So that's why we went and wrote then Training for the Uphill Athlete, which is our new book that just came out this past winter, because that's targeted to that audience. So it's been a real evolution. And of course, we're going to do better financially with this new book because we'll sell more than 2,000 copies, and hopefully we'll sell another 50 or 60,000 copies over the years. But hopefully we just pay ourselves back and break even on our time and provide a community service by giving for, you know, $27. People can buy this book and learn everything they need to know to self-coach for these mountain sports. That feels pretty good. That feels like a worthwhile mission.
Right. Yeah, it was like a passion project for you guys, and yet it resonated and it turned into something much bigger. I love that.
Well, it's turned into something even bigger than we imagined, in the sense that it's now turned into a whole community. Like, there's a ton of people out there, and we've just been on the road talking about our book, and so we've really encountered this firsthand, where there's a ton of people out there who are doing this. They're using our books and our website and our information that we're providing to create training plans and track their training and improve as mountain athletes, and they're doing their sports, and that's like their life. It's their community. It's like what we were talking about with our, you know, you were asking me about how important the climbing community has been in my life. It's creating these communities in all these different regions around, literally around the world, where people are coming together and saying like, oh yeah, like let's go train. Let's go do, have you done this workout from the book? Okay, let's do that Wednesday night. Meet you at 5 o'clock after work, kind of a thing. Like, that's happening. That blows us away that is happening. And also reinforces to me my vision of these sports as practice and not as quote unquote sport. It's people getting out and doing these things together, and you know, that's super inspiring to me. Really, really, really tickled to death, I guess, for me, that this is kind of like going on, because this is nothing I ever anticipated. It's nothing I benefit from. I just think it's really cool, and I'm really happy to have been a part of it.
Right. Yeah. So you, to go back a little bit to the Mount Temple accident, you wrote something in a Rock and Ice article that I saw. You wrote, quote, after my accident on Mount Temple in March 2010, I came to terms with the fact that I had not always been a nice person over the years prior. And you also wrote, quote, "The notoriety that came with climbing K7 and Naga Parbat's RuPaul face did affect me in a negative way. I wasn't prepared and I had no guidance." And so I'm curious to hear you talk about, like, kind of how the accident showed you kind of the person that you had been before with your climbing, kind of, and versus the person that you had, I guess, hoped to be, to work towards being after the accident. And because just those two quotes about, like, kind of maybe your ego or whatever it might be, you know, kind of taking the forefront there for a few years, possibly.
Absolutely. I mean, for about 10 years, really. And it was my ego, but it was also like I had this very clearly defined for myself goal, and that was to become the best alpinist I could become. And anything that didn't fit into that was out. So, you know, relationships, you know, a lot of things were just like, if it was convenient, fine. If it didn't serve that purpose, it was out. And I was super ruthless about that. And to be honest, that's a really good way to get good at something. You know, you can, you know, because, you know, you put 100% of your energy into this, into one goal. It doesn't really matter what it is, but if you do that into one goal, you will find that you can get really good at a very narrow thing, right? That was not being a well-rounded person. And I knew that. I knew that at the time, but it was sort of like it necessitated, like being the best I could be at that thing necessitated sometimes being a jerk, and I accepted that, and I lived it, and I lived up to it. Let's say. And the other thing with the fame, I shouldn't call it fame. I use the word notoriety, and that's a much better term, especially in climbing, because I mean before at least Alex Honnold, there's never been a truly famous climber, and that's really only possible because of the movie, right? So the kind of climbing I do, it's not possible to take cameras there, especially cameramen, women, and fixed ropes and all that other stuff. So it's a very unique set of circumstances that can lead to that. So, but what I was notorious, let's say, or well known, might be a better phrase, within the climbing community and in certain cultures that really pay attention to mountaineering, and those do not include any in North America. But when I would travel in Europe, like, I would get stopped on the street. I would get, like, the gas station attendant would, I would pull up to a gas station, I would have a rental car, I'd be over there climbing, and, you know, pull up a gas station, a rental car, and a gas station attendant would be like, come over to me and be like, you know, virtually fainting because Steve House was filling up at his station, and I'd have to sign posters, and he'd give me his free beer. And like, I don't know how many times I'd go into a restaurant in Europe or a bar or whatever. I would never have to pay. People would, like, random people would just, like, I'd ask for my check, and they'd be like, oh, that gentleman over there took care of me. Like, that happened all the time over there. And still, and honestly, still does. But when I was in my early 30s, I wasn't prepared, and I think also the climbers a little bit older than I am also frankly hadn't encountered it, because this was also kind of new within our sport, because our sport's growing so much, and so I didn't really have any guidance in it. And honestly, it's like, it's a little bit, and now I use a parenting reference because now I'm a parent, it's a little bit like parenting. If you teach a kid to be entitled, they'll embrace it. And they'll be super demanding, and they'll cry and whine if they don't get what they want. And that's kind of, you know, people treated me that way, and I was like, oh yeah, I deserve all this, you know. And nobody deserves anything. That's the reality, like, you know. And so those particular two things, the one being super self-centered and the other one starting to, you know, going down this road of feeling like I was entitled because people really began to treat me differently, that was a bad combination. I didn't have any way to handle it.
It seems almost very similar to even your story with training, that, like, before you met Scott, or before, like, you know, starting being coached by Scott Johnson, it seemed like the training was the typical adage of, you know, you want to get better at climbing, climb more. And it was only about climbing. And, you know, with your kind of, your personality, I guess, like you were saying, over those 10 years, it was only about climbing as well. But in terms of, like, your social interaction before you learned how to be more well-rounded, both in training and both in how you approached your kind of well, your ego and just your interaction with those around you in the community after the accident, it seems like they're very kind of parallel stories in a way.
Yeah, I actually honestly never thought about that. But I think in a way, that's the story of personal development, right?
Like, right.
We're all quite imperfect, and then something becomes the mirror where we realize, oh, you know, I don't really like that about myself, and I'm going to change it.
Right. Yeah, definitely. So I'm curious, kind of as we start to wrap up here, what are some of the, I guess, the key tactics or practices or skills, I guess you can say, in whatever way you want to put it, you know, that you've learned from, well, both from your time in the mountains, of course, but also from what you've learned from training smart and actually training instead of just, you know, going out and climbing and willy-nilly and trying to be fitter, but actually training smart and then applying that and being in the mountains and spending time out there and learning from the experience that you have. I'm curious, what are the takeaways that you have for kind of the listeners today?
You know, I think one of the best parallels or examples of that goes across all aspects of human endeavor, as far as I can tell, is this idea of consistency. And we use it in training in the sense that, you know, you need to train, you know, assuming you're healthy and, you know, we even start our, you know, relatively unfit athletes with 6 days a week. And some of those days may only be 20 minutes in the beginning, but they're training, and that consistency, and it's the same thing. Like, think about doing something difficult, like learning a language. Like, it's the same thing. If you can study or learn something for 20 minutes a day, I mean, you might not know that much after a week or after a month, but after 6 months, you sort of know something. And after a couple of years, you know a lot. And it's the same thing with training, that you can really make huge strides just by sticking to the simple concept of consistency and getting out the door into the gym every day, even if it's only a little bit. That will take you so far.
I completely agree. I mean, I think it's something that is hard to apply, though, you know, and I think that,
absolutely,
you know, that learning how to apply it and learning, like, battling through when you don't want to be consistent, when you'd rather stay in bed and not go to the gym or not go out on the trail or whatever it may be, you know, when you don't want to open that door and step outside, working through that, I think, is another one of the important benefits, because it, you know, it teaches you that idea of endurance, that idea of working through challenges, and showing up every day to do what you set out to do.
Yeah, it's absolutely true.
So I have what I call three motivationals, three little quick questions that I like to finish the show off with, but they're still kind of good wrap-ups, pretty important questions that I like to ask my every guest that I have on. So the first is quite simply, what's next for Steve House?
Oh boy. So I think that what's next for me is sticking to the consistency. And I've got a bunch of great things going here with my family, with Uphill Athlete, and with my own little personal climbing goals. You know, and I just try to keep everything, you know, relatively balanced and keep working away at things a little bit every day. And that's my goal, stay consistent.
Awesome. And what are your favorite books? Books that have shaped you, influenced you, impacted you?
Oh, favorite books. Oh, boy. you know, one book that I love that I try to – I haven't done it this year, but I try to read it every year. It's a really short book. It's called Man's Search for Meaning. It's called by Viktor Frankl, who's a Holocaust survivor.
Yeah.
It's not an unknown book. It's quite a well-known book, but – I think that that's just an incredible story and testament, you know, everything he did before and after the war. That's a really good one. You know, there's a climbing book that I've read. It's actually out of print and it's really hard to find, you know, virtually impossible to find. And there's a famous mountaineer named Reinhold Messner, who is kind of like probably, you know, Reinhold is about 75 now.
Right.
And he wrote a book when he was 25 years old called The Seventh Grade. And it's imperfect in a lot of ways. It's written by a 25-year-old. But, I mean, holy cow, did that guy have some stuff figured out. And it's very powerful, very direct, very short. But that is that has been an influential book for me because I've just related to that young Reinhold and the stories he told. And also, frankly, a lot of those stories are just part of the fabric of the history of climbing. And so, it's, you know, he was such a pioneer, even at an early age. So that was really important book for me in a lot of ways. And then one I read this winter that I really liked, and it's also a really popular book. I'm sure many people have read it. It's written by a guy named Ray Dalio, who is a hedge fund founder, manager. A lot of people have a huge variety of opinions about him as a person and as a businessman, but he wrote this book called Principles, which I thought was really interesting. Maybe it was imperfect, again, but he attempted to take from his business and personal life experiences, he attempted to create some principles, some immutable rules that you could use across a huge variety of situations that he could sort of divine or derive from things that he had experienced, both his successes and failures as a businessman. I thought there was some great stuff in there. Again, maybe it's not perfect, but the effort was very, very noble, and he had some great insights into a number of different things. And I liked how he presented that. It was a really good book.
Awesome. I'll have to check those out. Well, Man's Search for Meaning, actually, my dad just read that, and he's been telling me to read it too. So that'll probably be first on the list up next for me.
It's a quick read too. You'll probably read it in one night if you don't start too late.
Okay.
You won't be able to put it down.
I'm definitely looking forward to it. And finally, do you do any meditation? Do you practice any meditation?
You know, I historically have practiced a lot of meditation. Actually, through one of my climbing partners when I was in my early 20s, turned me on to Vipassana style meditation, and he sort of talked me into doing my first Vipassana retreat, which was a 10-day silent retreat. And I've done a number of those since then, but I haven't practiced regularly actually since my accident. I practiced through some of the recovery after my accident. But then in a way, I sort of felt like it was really powerful for my climbing because I think one of the things I was good at as a climber was the mental side. I was able to calm my mind and focus on what needed to be done in high stress situations. I was able to make good decisions in high stress situations and not be, you know, emotional or clouded in my judgments. But I feel like it sort of ran its course, and I'm sure I'll return to it at some point in life, but at the moment it's not something that's been part of my daily routine.
Right. Do you feel that you want to make it a daily practice at some point again, or?
You know, I don't have that expectation about how the frequency anymore. I used to, and that used to, especially in the beginning, feel really important that it was like it was daily practice, same time, et cetera, and same length, and I'd get my, you know, hour in or whatever. But I've kind of really lost that. It's been something, I think maybe partly because I've done it quite a bit, it's been something I can kind of drop into fairly easily, which the bad part of that is it means that I could drop out of it very easily. I'm like, oh yeah, I could still do that. Like I could still like get into that, you know, space pretty easily and access that. So I feel like I don't, but I also know the more I do it, the deeper I go into the practice, the better it gets, the better you know, so I know that, but at the moment, it's just it's not as important as other things to spend time on. And having little young kids, I have a less than 1-year-old and a 3-year-old, so that kind of makes that kind of routine and practice very difficult to implement in reality because it's a certain degree of chaos that's not normally part of adult life.
Well, thanks for coming on the show, Steve. I had a blast.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for making some time. I really enjoyed chatting with you, so thanks.
You're very welcome. Look forward to hearing some of your next guests. Keep up the great work.
And that was that. Episode 180 of the Touching the Trail podcast with this week's guest, Steve House. If you want to find out more about what Steve is up to, you can head on over to uphillathlete.com and stevehouse.net. You can also look up Training for the New Alpinism and Training for the Uphill Athlete wherever books are sold. If you want to find out more about what Touching the Trail is up to, you can head on over to touchingthetrail.com, where you can read the writings, you can read the resources on meditation, on food, and on recommended readings. You can sign up for the weekly newsletter, and if you ever have any questions or comments, or if you just want to talk, you can always reach out to me via the contact page on the website. You can also follow us on social media at Touching the Trail on Instagram, at Touch the Trail on Twitter, and the Touching the Trail page on Facebook. If you haven't done so already, make sure to subscribe to the show if you're enjoying what you hear, and make sure to share it out with your friends and your family and your coworkers and everyone else. And if you're loving the show every week, please leave a review. Let me know that you're out there and that you're listening and that you like what I do every week. If you want to help support Touching the Trail, you can head on over to touchingthetrail.com/donate to donate to the show, and you can do however much you want, but I just ask that you consider donating, because the show is built and based in the Buddhist concept of dana, generosity, of giving, and so I cannot continue to improve and expand what I do here without your help. You can also go to targetreleaserecovery.com to pick up your very own Basecamp and Peak. Now, these are functional, affordable, unique, and handmade, handheld deep tissue massage tools. And all those links are in the show notes, as always. So going forward this week, please remember to stay consistent, as Steve talked about. It really is probably one of the most important ideals and practices that you can take away from any type of endurance sport, to apply both to training better for that endurance sport and to being better in daily life. As always, remember to go far, go further, and I will see you all next week on the Touching the Trail podcast. Thanks for listening. The Touching the Trail podcast.